If you've been following the buzz about artificial intelligence in Africa, you've probably heard both grand optimism and stark warnings. Some observers insist that Africa could leapfrog other regions to capitalize on AI. But others argue that actually AI may fall at the first hurdle in Africa because of a basic infrastructure gaps. Nigerian investor Tony Elumelu put it bluntly. Africa should not even talk about AI, he says, when access to common electricity is not available on the continent. And hundreds of millions of Africans still lack access to electricity, and internet connectivity lags far behind the global average. Without power and connectivity, will the AI revolution stall before it gets started on the continent? Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev.
And I'm Dina Musa, a researcher and grantmaker at Coefficient Giving. In this series on AI and development, we're exploring how AI might impact low and middle income countries. Today's episode asks, what needs to happen first for an AI boom in Africa? Is the continent prepared, or will AI falter at the first hurdle based on lacking infrastructure? We're lucky to be joined by Rose Mutiso, founder of the Africa Tech Futures Lab and previously the research director for the Energy Growth Hub. Rose has been writing and thinking about how African countries can harness new technologies like AI, and crucially, what fundamental bottlenecks must be removed first.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, Rose, you've worked at the intersection of energy and technology in Africa for years. To start, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your journey and how you ended up focusing on AI and development issues.
Yeah, Oliver. So the kind of becoming an AI person is a little, which I even hesitate to call myself that, but I've kind of fallen into it, which is sometimes it's kind of annoying because like right now everyone has gone AI. So sometimes it's like I'm a cliche when I say like I'm, and I didn't mean to turn into this AI cliche, but so maybe I'll give the backstory. So, you know, I have a kind of science academic background. I did my PhD in material science and applied physics. And at the time, I was actually looking at materials for kind of digital technology, but from a basic science perspective. So like that's kind of like the prehistory of like I've always thought about science and tech. I then transitioned to energy policy because at the time I was interested in science and technology policy and energy. This is like a little bit of our decade ago, energy was kind of like a big focus of innovation policy. Still is, but especially then. So for me, it was like, this is a good segue. I also studied materials for energy tech. So I was like, okay, this is a good thing. And then energy also had relevance for development, which I really loved because I wanted to tie back to Africa and Kenya, where I'm from, and kind of have my research more relevant to the world's poorest and not just doing this kind of cutting edge stuff I was doing in the lab. Working on energy, I then took on climate because obviously energy transitions, energy tech, climate becomes a topic. And then fast forward, energy and climate basically now have become the center of AI. And so I just kind of found myself talking about AI because then now suddenly AI, you know, like such a focus of AI discourse is energy demand, implications for climate. And then obviously development, which has always been like a ride along or like a key part of like what I've been thinking about. And so now I always say that like for me, I'm coming to AI as kind of this, it's an extracurricular that grew out of my core focus on energy and climate policy, but then it brings me back to my first love, which is science and technology policy for development.
Let's set the scene for listeners. Rose, so before we can have an AI boom in Africa, certain basics need to be in place. At a fundamental level, what infrastructure or prerequisites does a country need for an AI takeoff? Or in other words, what is absolutely essential for AI to become widespread in a particular area?
I wrote about this recently, and I've written a couple of pieces in Science, if you look them up, a couple of commentaries on this, where I was really trying to like reflect on this. I think, Oliver, you said this in the beginning, there's a lot of buzz but about, you know, AI as this kind of miracle thing. But then I think it's really helpful to go back to what underpins the meta-narrative. about the AI. And so, you know, I think like for me, three things really stood out, especially for Africa. I think there's a longer list of fundamentals, but I pulled out three. One is power. You know, AI is energy hungry. A lot of this is focused on the data center infrastructure, which I think a lot of listeners have heard about. And so these are kind of, you know, the physical backbone of the AI economy, but also a lot of the internet and our entire digital ecosystem. And these are like these massive warehouses that contain servers that host all, you know, data processing power, you know, and really, really energy hungry. And so power is electricity, affordable, reliable, green electricity is a must have. I think the second thing is just connectivity, right? So you need digital infrastructure. So fiber optic cables, you know, networks, and just people who are able to access digital internet services affordably. And I think that this conversation, there has been a conversation for a while about the connectivity gap in Africa that has, you know, been focused on how many internet users do we have? How many, like, say, mobile internet users? And so I think in the AI age, this is, it's not just access, it's really connectivity infrastructure that is needed. So it's not enough to say that like X, you know, percent of Africans are using it on their phones. This is like for AI, the connectivity demands are really next level. And data centers are also part of that equation because they're obviously a critical part of the digital infrastructure that kind of makes connectivity possible. And then the last thing is data. So AI, as we know, runs on data. In poor countries like Africa, where your data is scarce, you're just invisible. You're literally invisible in the AI ecosystem, and you have no way to really operationalize AI, parameterize the models, and kind of make these tools like usable and relevant and powerful in your context, in your business, in, you know, whatever use case.
You mentioned data centers in your answer. Stepping back to basics a little bit, what does a data center actually do?
Yeah, so this is such a good question because I think like I feel like we should just play data center as kind of bingo. It's like how many times in a day will I hear the word data center? And it's true. It's like we take for granted that, you know, what this is. So I think, as I said earlier, the data center is really the physical backbone of the digital economy. I think at its simplest, it's a warehouse that's filled with computers or servers that store data and process information for websites, for cloud services, for AI. If you think of, you know, for example, your laptop, you have your memory, you have your processor. So just think of this at like massive scale and accessible to anyone, anywhere simultaneously. And so I think this is really helpful because people often think, say, like the internet is invisible, but it's actually quite physical. And actually almost all of the internet's content is stored physically on these servers, in these data centers, in these warehouses all over the world. And so, you know, it's just basically massive warehouses with huge computers that store all of our data, that process our data, that process our computing tasks. And for AI, in the age of AI, is that the volume, speed, intensity of this computing demand is just going to be higher.
So it sounds like these basics that you've just mentioned of kind of electricity, internet, and data are going to be quite big hurdles, right? In your view, how close or far are African countries from having the necessary infrastructure? For example, we already noted kind of this huge electricity access gap and lower internet penetration. Are there countries that are making good progress on these fronts? Or is there kind of this broad kind of lagging on the continent?
Yeah, so I think that both things are true, that there's a huge gap. There's a lot of kind of, the lag is real. So, you know, there's a huge energy poverty gap in Africa. 600 million people lack access. Reliability and affordability, even where you have access, is a problem. So electricity prices are some of the highest in the world in Africa, very unreliable. As you know, the internet access gaps and usage are quite low. So I think only 38% of Africans were online in 2024 versus 68% globally. The fiber optic network backbone is growing, but still limited. again, data, I mean, it's like, I could rattle like the list of depressing stats, like only 1% of global data center capacities in Africa. And actually, like an interesting sidebar on data center capacity. I was recently in Switzerland giving a lecture and I was like, okay, let me, you know, I have my slide deck that I was like, let me freshen it up and customize it to the Swiss audience. And so I did a research about data local. I wanted a local comparator for like data centers in Switzerland, which has a population of 9 million, has about 116 data centers. This is as of several months ago. And Africa with 1.5 billion people has only 230. So it's just like these gaps are huge. They are bright spots because, you know, I think in certain countries like South Africa, Kenya, Nigeria, Morocco, Egypt, there's a lot of growth in fiber optic networks, data centers, mobile network and internet networks are growing, user base is growing in Africa. We have some supercomputer clusters in Morocco and South Africa, for example. There are more AI researchers and startups. So there is progress, but it's highly concentrated. And so I think that there's a lot of heterogeneity and a lot of like imbalance locally. That being said, you know, and I think I'm recalling, Oliver, in your opening, you quoted Tony Elumelu saying like, if we don't have energy access, we shouldn't even talk about AI. I disagree. I wouldn't take it that far. So because, you know, first, like they are, it's not all the same in Africa. So they're like in like, you know, hotspots, like in capitals like Nairobi or like outside of Joburg or Cape Town or Lagos. You know, there is growth, there's usage, stuff is happening, there's expansion. And also you don't, not everything has to be, you can sequence the usage and the growth. Like you don't have to have the perfect kind of total system in place. You know, and so there's sequencing, there's low hanging fruits, there's like, first adopters, there are ways that you can target for the system you have as you kind of grow and build out the fundamentals and kind of fill the gaps, but you have to fill them in like a kind of a sensible priority way.
Rose, we often hear this about this idea that lower resource settings can leapfrog past traditional hurdles using new technological developments. And this happened most famously with mobile phones leapfrogging landlines, and also with mobile banking leapfrogging traditional brick and mortar banks. So some people, I think, are proposing perhaps Africa can leapfrog into AI, even if infrastructure is currently lacking. For example, by using AI even in cases without internet access through downloadable models. Is AI, in your view, a case where leapfrogging is possible, or are the fundamentals unavoidable here?
Super great question. Another one for my bingo card is leapfrogging. It's like a term that follows me everywhere I go. I've been thinking about leapfrogging. I recently wrote about this also, maybe in the show notes you can link to. I wrote a piece called Five Rules of Leapfrogging in Africa, because I have been thinking about this. And I want it to be, I think the short answer is, which is reflected in my piece, it's not yes or no, it's something in between. But I will say AI is not a classic leapfrog technology. So the canonical example is mobile phones, right? And mobile phones worked because they bypassed expensive legacy infrastructure. But AI kind of does the opposite. It actually does depend heavily on infrastructure, on energy, data, compute institutions, you see what I mean? And so there's this kind of, people associate digital tech things with leapfrogging because like now it's like everything is on your phone, like do it with an app. And so you've leapfrogged. But then I think AI is tricks us because the infrastructure layer seems hidden in the kind of appification narrative. And so I think it's hard to do AI. You can do AI without this infrastructure. I think that there, you know, ways to be a bit more creative, like sharing infrastructure regionally. I mean, right now, you know, Africans are on ChatGPT, and the ones who are probably doing it via like the data centers in Europe, and like the data is coming through undersea cables. And so we are, you know, without data center capacity on the continent, we are able to access infrastructure offshore elsewhere. But this is not a long-term, you know, sustainable proposition. So I think that Africa can innovate creatively with AI, but it's not something that can really be done at scale without these ecosystem investments. And this is not just AI. This is also for the digital tech. Like I also came when I was like in undergrad and then grad school, it was like tech for development was a big thing. And people also thought that we could use mobile tech, whatever, to leapfrog everything. And, improve farmer yields. And that's true to some extent, but you kind of hit against these kind of constraints.
Great. So assuming that everyone kind of recognizes that we need to kind of fix some of these basic issues that exist, the big question then becomes how to do it. And referring to another article that you recently wrote, and we will link to all of these in the show notes, you outlined these three steps to basically unlock the potential of AI in Africa. The first step relates to something that we've been talking about already, which is kind of addressing this root problem of affordable, reliable power. In practical terms, what does that involve? And are there any opportunities where the tech industry could actually be helpful in that? For example, using data centers or renewable energy projects to kill two birds with one stone?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, so I always, maybe I'm a little bit biased because I'm kind of an energy person, but you know, we just need to build more power, full stop. So we just need to invest in generation, transmission, distribution infrastructure across the continent. Why I love this as a solution is because it's not just for AI, it's literally for everything, you know? And so there are some debates about like, are we being distracted by AI? Should we be focusing on more pressing issues? And I think power is that great thing where it's just like, it lifts all boats. And so that's like the one thing you know, efforts are underway, but you know, this is like, I don't want to open the whole kind of worms of all of the constraints to expanding power, but I think dealing with those, which like the people in the energy space are aware of, and are working on that, that is a priority. I think AI does create an opportunity in power. So data centers, as you mentioned, they can act as an anchor for utilities. Utilities in Africa are generally broke. They struggle to get large power user customers to help, you know, provide revenue. And so a data center could be a really good customer. Unlike, you know, because they provide predictable demand, they can help you improve power quality because like their standards are high, so they can raise the standards and they can help finance grid upgrades. But this only is with really good management and coordination. Otherwise, you could have a repeat of what's happening in rich countries where AI power demand is a threat to the system. I think that it need not be a threat in African countries where you do need more demand, you need more large power users, but it has to be managed really, really well. You know, so I think those are the kind of big power sector solutions. I think there are other solutions we can discuss later that are not that outside of the power sector in terms of how especially tech companies can be kind of help rather than hinder.
Well, I guess we could go into those now if you'd like. So what are those other solutions?
Yeah, so, you know, the cloud services are still quite expensive in Africa, and most of the tech majors like Amazon Cloud Services and Google and the rest of them, and Oracle, whatever, they only have cloud regions in South Africa. They don't have a lot of coverage. If you want to have access to AI services on the cloud, the subscriptions are quite expensive. I've worked with African researchers that like it's really, really hard to pay for access to the services. And so I know that there are some initiatives underway and we need more of them where you have subsidized access for African students or researchers or experts, and just kind of like trying to get at the cost and accessibility barrier. And I think that tech companies can be a partner for that. We've had tech companies in the past work with African institutions with equipment. So, you know, I know in South Africa, which is like our kind of first like supercomputer region in Africa, you know, some of those the original supercomputer clusters were seeded through partnerships with tech companies, equipment donations, collaborations, technical skill exchanges. And so I think that just reducing the barrier to entry for individual researchers, experts, users, and also institutions could be one way that, you know, we could have partnerships as well.
And going back to your three steps to unlock the potential of AI, the second that you write about was that African governments should act as enablers rather than trying to direct the technological transformations that are underway. I guess, what does that mean in practice for governments to be enablers rather than orchestrators? And are there any kind of practical examples you can give of governments who have taken on that role?
Yeah, so this comment came from, I think I was reacting to like the African obsession with writing really long sprawling plans and strategies and agendas. We love a good strategy. We love a good vision document. And so we started to see these AI strategies and documents come online, including from the AU. And my observation is over and over again, they're just like everything under the sun. Like, you know, just we are going to do everything. We're going to lofty language. We're going to invest all of this, you know, and it's just like government cannot do all of those things. And so we do nothing. You know, you just have these pointless like strategies that kind of are completely toothless. And so I think that African governments are starting to think of themselves as not like holding everything in the space and orchestrating and like having their like policy planning kind of reflect that posture and just being really specific on where their levers and which levers make sense in the short, medium, long term. And so some of those levers are, for example, just getting the market right. So clear rules on power contracts, land, data, government, competition. So, you know, just the telco explosion in, for example, countries like Kenya in the early 2000s, a lot of that was regulatory. And the government kind of creating this like regulatory signal that, you know, enabled investment to come in. And so that's like a really kind of a level government can use. I think reducing friction in terms of permitting, speeds, harmonized regional standards, predictable regulation. I think the regional standards is really important because like what the African Union does with the data sovereignty, and data protection, data privacy rules, having a standard rule for all of Africa will also kind of have a lot of bearing on how different players can operate and kind of have a shared market as opposed to just having a hodgepodge of many conflicting standards and stuff like that. I think that the government can also create demand. So if you digitize public services, you become a huge source of demand for digital infrastructure and digital services. And you catalyze local cloud and data ecosystems. And governments in particular, they can demand that because of sensitive information, they say that our stuff has to be housed on local data centers. You know, everything has to be localized. And so they can really put pressure in that way. And then I would say then just targeted public investment. So you can invest in everything you don't have the money to, and you're kind of deluding yourself with these like sprawling strategies, but like, where can you be strategic in your context, in your region? Like which strategic kind of ways that you can deploy funding for research or improve public data systems or skill through the education system? Or what are priority sectors? I remember I was like earlier this year, I was looking at like AI strategies for some Scandinavian countries. I don't know if it was Norway or Denmark, I forget. But like, you know, they had like a whole section on fisheries, I think. And because like that is a priority, it was like AI for this, you know, sector, priority sector. It's a huge sector of the economy, you know? And so, you know, so you could see here, there's a little bit of like customization, like, you know, not everyone is going to have an AI sub-strategy for fisheries, but, you know, Norway can because that matters to them. So just being really targeted. So I think the key idea is that like governments can orchestrate, but they can help steer constructively. And that takes a lot of self-awareness about like what your levers are.
The third step you discuss is reducing barriers to entry for local AI players. I think this seems really important. Rather than just being about big infrastructure, it's also about localizing the work and empowering people who are within context to create and use AI. What kind of barriers do local researchers and entrepreneurs face in this space, and how can we lower them?
So great question. Something I'm also really passionate about. And this kind of goes back to my earlier point in terms of how you reduce barriers for early adopters. And so before I go into the barriers bit, I just want to talk a little bit about the early adopters. I think there's a kind of sub-narrative now about how we need to like AI access for all. And so like the most rural person in the most rural part of like, how do we not leave them behind? I'm sympathetic, obviously, to the idea of like the gaps, especially rural urban and like ultra poor and whatnot. But I think for new technology, you know, adoption patterns, and we know this from just the history of tech innovation and how new technology is adopted, they're always fast adopters. And even in the US and Europe, the first adopters right now are companies. It's not like the everyday grandma using AI necessarily. And so I think that we really need to be intentional about, like, who are those first adopters? Who are the companies, businesses, entrepreneurs, startup researchers? Who are they? Government agencies? And then how can we reduce barriers for them, as opposed to prematurely trying to reduce barriers for, like, super last mile, where it's like, this is, in a sequencing way, might not make sense in the near term. So in terms of the ways, I think the main barriers are, you know, prohibitively expensive cloud computing and compute access, which we've discussed already, poor access to high quality data, just across the board. And this is especially even with new data sources opening up. I know a lot of researchers who, you know, have to pay for, like, really expensive, like, satellite data sets, which is, you know, an area of, like, it's like this new rich area of new data, but it's still expensive for the people who need it the most. I think there's limited funding for research, experimentation, early stage startups, and then there's skills gaps and weak links to global research networks. So I think what can help is, first and foremost, I think stronger ecosystem infrastructure that will lift all boats. So there's just, I'll say this over and over, I'll just be a broken record, that if you just fix reliable power, affordable pricing, invest in education, if you do just those things that you should be doing anyway, I think that helps everyone and reduces barriers directly and indirectly. I think, like, you know, more subsidized or shared cloud and computer access is really important. Like we've said, investment in public data. And I think one thing I've also seen is small grants really go a long way. I think some last year or something, Nigerian Digital Tech Ministry or something like that, they just run this, like, grants program with pretty small, I don't know, it's like maybe a few thousand dollars. But, you know, the tons of people applied and, like, a bunch of really interesting projects were supported through that. And so, I mean, from a US perspective, that seems like change. But, you know, I had a mentor who just needed $2,000 to buy a gaming laptop so that she could do her analysis, and she did and completed her PhD. You know, so it's really small grants can have a huge, huge difference. And then just more opportunities for regional collaboration. And whether it's on infrastructure sharing or training, and this is in the region globally, just having more people working together is really an important way to reduce barriers. For African and kind of would-be AI participants in poor countries. I just launched a new think tank called the African Tech Futures Lab. And next year, we're going to be on the lookout for rising kind of thinkers, African thinkers, both in Africa and the diaspora on AI. And so if you're one of those people, please get in touch. Email me. We have an info sheet on our website, www.africantechfutures.org. But we are really interested in finding thought leaders that can help us kind of set the tone and the vision for how we should be thinking about AI in ways that are more constructive, in ways that cut through the buzz, that kind of don't just, like, recycle tired, empty claims. You know, like, how can we both get technical and detailed, but also package this thinking in ways that is accessible, that kind of help give like general publics and policymakers a steer in terms of, like, this is how we should be thinking about this for XYZ reason. And I think that we have a lot of visible thought leaders commenting on AI and this rapid transformation in the global north. Like, in, you know, I think I subscribe to several Substacks just by US thinkers on this, and I want to help create the African people whose Substacks I can also follow, who tell me, like, hey, here's the African slice. So if you're one of those people, please get in touch, and we will be trying to build that cohort out next year.
That sounds like a great initiative. And thank you again, Rose, for your time. This has been Ideas in Development. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us 5 stars or a thumbs up wherever you are watching or listening. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.